Hello, and welcome to an episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives, where we are live at the ACE 2026 meeting in Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have a very special guest, Dr. Linda DiMaglio, who was honored with the Ellen Garber Award and gave a plenary keynote. And so we're so excited to have you as a guest, and we'd love if you don't mind just introducing yourself and describing a little bit about your role and what you do.
Sure. So thank you for having me. This is my first ACE meeting, so it's been really great to experience it. I am a professor of pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine. I've been there almost 30 years. I currently serve as the division chief there, and I also run a type 1 diabetes research team at IU. The team is focused on preventing type 1, a new therapeutics in the beta cell preservation space, and then technology and therapeutics for people with established type 1 diabetes. I also work as vice chair of type 1 diabetes TrialNet, and I'm co-chairing a study of neurocognition in young kids, which I'm very excited about, with living with diabetes. And then I also I'm co-PI of a national physician scientist training program. So a lot of different, a lot of different hats in that diabetes space. Yeah.
That's really awesome. So you gave an incredible keynote today. It was so well attended and it heard rave reviews on it. Can you give us like a little bit of an overview of what you talked about?
Sure. So I spoke about broadly early stage type 1 diabetes. So I started off by talking about kind of definitions of early stage diabetes and who is at risk of diabetes, which I define as people who either have known genetics that would predispose them to type 1 or people have a single autoantibody. And then through stage 1, stage 2, stage 3 of type 1 diabetes, I talked about the screening landscape. So where things are going and the increases in general population screening as well as the continued screening of relatives. We talked about approaches to monitoring, leaned on the breakthrough T1D consensus guidance statement in that space, which is a great resource, and then talked about where we are with therapeutics. So teplizumab for early stage diabetes. I was excited to be able to say that it was approved yesterday down to the age of 1 for stage 2. That's a great advance. Mm-hmm. And then I talked a little bit about kind of where we're going in a lot of the open clinical trials, particularly in the stage 3 space, but also for stage 2 and stage 1 diabetes. And really the goal being that we want to try to end insulin dependence for people living with type 1.
Wow. I was really taken the number of different medications that people are thinking about using. Yeah. There's a handful. We all kind of know this, but no, there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
So I love that. And you know, it's easy to identify someone as stage 3. They're, as a pediatrician, most of them in your hospital today, those are easy and you can then use a drug. The idea of, can we do this quickly to preserve that residual beta cell function right now, today?
Correct.
And that was surprising to me. But I also love the idea that you said, wait a minute, why can't we go back to stage 1? Why can't we give drugs in stage 1? Why are we waiting to have dysglycemia? I love that idea too.
Yeah, and some people would even say that stage 1 is late because you already have the autoimmunity. So what if you could even do things to prevent, you know, that beginning of the process and really go back? Because we know that the people's paths to developing type 1 diabetes vary. So the reason that one person develops type 1 and the second person may be very different. But if we could intercede like as early as possible, it would be great overall. We're getting there.
It feels like the momentum in the past 5 to 10 years has completely shifted. As a clinician from the outside, because I do adults. Can you talk a little bit about that?
No, I think so. I mean, I think there's still that underlying frustration that we haven't found a cure, but I think that the reframing of cures was really important. So that came from Aaron Kowalski, I think, at one point. I mean, people are talking about it, but I think he really messaged that out through Breakthrough T1D. So the fact that we needed to try multiple approaches. Somebody asked me recently, like, what the most exciting thing I was doing in my research was, and I firstly asked if I had to choose kind of one thing, but overall, I think that the idea that we're starting to use things in combinations is really, really important, and we really have intentional combinations. The trial that we just finished recruiting for in trial not using rituximab, followed by abatacept, was based on a failed trial with abatacept, but data suggesting that abatacept would actually be beneficial in people who had been treated with rituximab, like the effects on immune cells look like that. I think that's exciting. And I'm also excited about the idea of potentially personalizing what we're doing, again, based on the etiology of diabetes in the person, but also other characteristics, and learning more about how we can, you know, tailor treatment. Because you would never, at least for most cancers, you would never just give one therapy for a few weeks and then stop and then say, okay, you're cured. And with diabetes, we keep trying to do those sorts of things and not like coming back in. So the other thing I didn't have a chance to talk about today, which is like we also need to develop more intermediate endpoints so that we can, rather than 2-year C-peptide, which is what we tend to use to try to move that field forward. But I do think the energy, I mean, having a drug approved for stage two has really, I mean, I have my master's in public health. And so you don't want to screen for disease unless you have a treatment. So that helped us with that. So though we were pushing saying we can screen to prevent DKA, I think also have prevent DKA, but then also have a treatment was very important.
I think so too. And I think your point of it took us so long to recruit for it took us so long to get, you know, to get people to even be willing to screen the first time.
Yeah.
I do feel like that is that there is now a wave of people saying we really do need to screen and recognizing it. Because getting the first diplizumab trial executed took years and years and years to get enough positives to do the trial.
Correct.
I think this is that same idea. I'm feeling more and more people are requesting screening.
Right. I think the other thing that we're doing a better job on, which is critical, is really incorporating the voices and the perspectives of the people that we're asking to recruit into the trials. So TrialNet finally set up a community advisory board. Which is expertly run by Christine March and Ingrid Libman at Pittsburgh. They'd be great people to talk about on your podcast at some point, but talk with. But they, and so they're informing like the trial design of future trials, the community members. And I think that'll help us figure it out figure out ways to get trials done more expeditiously. Yeah, you could give a whole separate talk. Like I had to focus in my talk today on screening, monitoring, and then briefly talk about directions, but there's a lot to think about in that space.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk on like islet cell transplants. Yes. And I'm curious like where the research is going there. Are we going to see more success with that?
I think it's very exciting. I occasionally people ask me to like speak about that, and I'll be like, "That is not
that's my gig, right? Yeah,
it's exactly. not my gig." I follow it, and I think and somebody asked me today, like, "When do you think you'll have encapsulated islet cells that we can really?" I don't know. I used to think of it as a race, but I actually think that they're kind of complementary approaches. Mm-hmm. I think that's also very exciting. I think anything that would reduce the day-to-day burden and hassles that, and they say that people who live with type 1 diabetes make hundreds of decisions a day that people without diabetes don't need to make about everything, food, insulin, you know, exercise, what are you going to do? Like even just like, I mean, coming to a meeting like this, it was a hassle for me to get here and I don't live with type 1, but I didn't have to pack my pods and my insulin and my, you know, like all those different things. So if you could reduce the burden, whether it's through islet transplant or through having more beta cells through immune modulation. And I also think it's possible that what we're doing in diabetes also will inform other disease states as well. I mean, we were the first with teplizumab, was the first disease modifying therapy for an autoimmune disease. So, you know, maybe we can before onset, right? To delay onset. I mean, we took drugs that from psoriasis, from alopecia, from all RA, like all those kinds of things, and we moved them back. But then, you know, can we also shift the paradigms for other autoimmune diseases? I think that'd be really interesting.
I mean, what potential, right? Like that's, it's exciting that it's going, that it has the potential to spread to not just diabetes, right?
It's a paradigm shift though for us, I think, in the field, because I mean, most of us who are endocrinologists firstly didn't go into endocrinology because we wanted all this data that we have all the time around all the technologies and everything that we do in clinical care. But also, I didn't go into endocrinology to be able to, you know, to manage cytokine release and these immune modulations and infections and all that kind of stuff. So I love learning new things. So it's been interesting. And we've had to partner with people in other fields who do that much more routinely. But I think it'll change these sorts of things will also change a little bit the makeup of our workforce, which I think is really going to be interesting as well.
Right. You talked a lot about screening today. And I know in the Q&A, there were a lot of questions about like GAD autoantibody.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about like how that isn't the most specific and kind of what do we do if it's positive or what, why it could be falsely positive or
how? Yeah, we had a lot of questions today about like what specific autoantibodies mean, what specific titers mean, the change in definition from the ADA to say that you don't need in stage one diabetes, you can have stage one or stage two if you're only single autoantibody positive, and how that moved the label for teplizumab, because the teplizumab label is based upon ADA standards of care, which isn't really also a really interesting paradigm. I think it's going to make for a lot more thought, I think, around which antibodies are the most specific and sensitive. For sure, one of the things I kept saying during the talk, too, the things I want anyone listening to this and anyone who heard my talk today to remember is that a single test for islet autoantibodies is not enough. You need to, if it's positive, you need to repeat it, ideally in a different lab, ideally in a gold standard lab. For me, that my go-to is always the TrialNet, because anybody on the outside who is antibody positive can come into TrialNet and get all four antibodies, sometimes five antibodies, depending on the antibody profile, tested in a gold standard lab. But that low-level GAD was something people talked a lot about because it's not very specific to type 1, and yet you see it in somebody with diabetes, and you're like, is this type 1 or type 2? One of the things that came out is the higher the titer, the more specific that could be, and also the certain types of antibodies are more specific. Although I think we are sometimes seeing very high levels of zinc antibodies that don't replicate or may not repeat in another lab. But I think it's a nuanced field. I think we need more data. We also need more data from populations that are not all like Northern European to figure out what this looks like in that. And we need more data in adults from screening, and also more data in adults for drugs like teplizumab as well.
Yeah, because in adults, it's often the only autoantibody to check for. And if someone has diabetes and then they're positive, we assume they have type 1, but it kind of makes me wonder, maybe falsely assuming sometimes? I don't know.
And in general, I would for sure follow up in that case with all four. I think that will help. Now, on somebody on insulin, the insulin antibody won't be reliable. And somebody with long-standing diabetes, the other thing we talked about is you will sometimes lose those autoantibodies over time, although people will still have them. I think antibody, it's nice that we can now code for it. We can deal for early stage diabetes. It's made that part a little easier. But a lot of the other thing that came up a lot in the discussion is how does what we're coding for and billing for affect insurance and willingness to reimburse for drugs as well. That's very context dependent. So in Indiana, my experience with that may be different than you guys would have in Ohio or anywhere else in the country. There's a lot of nuance to what we do. I guess we're not going to put ourselves out of jobs anytime soon, although we want to make our decision-making easier and be able to explain it to people in a more easy to understand way.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. This one single antibody, and sometimes they dance, right? I mean, I have a patient right now through TrialNet who was two antibody positive for years. Then she went down to one. Now she's at zero. And she's the mom of a child with type 1. We still have to continue to follow her because they kind of know they're probably going to come back maybe one day, but she was positive for at least two.
Yeah, yeah.
And not always the same two for several years, right?
It's really interesting.
These are dancy, right? They're like, okay, I'm this, I'm that.
Yeah.
And so that's the challenge with this too, is it's not like it's a yes or no. It's not an on or off for everyone. Yeah. And those nuances, I think people who would screen, they want a yes or no, right? And clinicians want a yes or no. So they don't want to hear that you have to screen at, 2 to 3, 4 to 6, 9 to 11. They want to say, is it on or is it off?
Yes, right? And so families want that too.
Families want that. Yeah. I would want that, right? Yeah. So that whole discussion is going to be something that as we understand more about which antibodies, all of that, I think it's going to help us frame our discussions better, right? And make them easier to have. And as more of us have these conversations, it makes it easier to have. We're learning every day, I guess.
I'll say the other nuance I just want to answer quickly is that the other thing that I talked about briefly and we're still, it's like tantalizing to me, is that the antibodies may also vary by time of day.
Yes. That was
and
a,
so when you I, repeat I, yes. that, I don't really quite understand why they do. It's been observed in other cases. We know that vaccines given at certain times of day are more or less effective. So it makes sense. You know, immune cells circulate by time of day. I mean, they're still going to be effective, but you can increase the efficacy of some things by giving it certain times a day. And so people are asking me, like, what's the right time of day? I'm like, I don't know. Like, based on what we've seen so far, people with established diabetes may be in the morning, but it varies based on the antibody you're chasing as well. But I think that's also something we need to continue to look at and understand in the space.
Yeah, that is fascinating.
It was. I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
You talked in the beginning about genetic risk. How come we can't do, or we don't do more genetic screening?
People would advocate for that. I think it's, my understanding is it's been a little bit harder to scale that, but that's like not my area of expertise per se. We tend to do, it may be somewhat reluctance to do genetic screening, in just a societal reluctance to do it as well. But, there are certainly, Bill Hagopian in particular would be an advocate to say that you should do the genetic screen, enrich your population, and then do the screening. I think the other challenge there, though, is if you don't screen everybody, if you say from a public health perspective, you say, I'm only going to capture people based upon genetic risk score, and then I'm going to follow them over time, then you have to have a way to capture that population and really go back to them. Right. Whereas if you're just going to have everybody, like some school-based systems like they have in Australia, everybody in that grade gets screened and they just come through in some ways, even though you're screening more people, if you're doing it with a cheaper test and you're doing it to everybody, it may be easier than honing in on people early on. But I think where things are moving are to more multiplexed antibodies more than like widespread genetic screening. But we'll see. I could be wrong.
Awesome.
Wow, cool. So much more to talk about. So many. We need to have you come back next year and give us an update is what we need, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, I do so. Hopefully we'll have more data by then.
That's exactly
it. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Well,
absolutely.
This has been a great discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. And congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a huge honor. I learned a lot about Alan Garber. His wife was here today. It was interesting. I feel humbled to be getting the award, but excited to talk about this area of work.
Yeah, you're very deserving. Thank you so much for being here. We thank you all for tuning in. And that wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.
Thanks, everyone.